the first thing I think we have to establish is the question of what is death actually is getting to the essence or the nature of death, which is actually a philosophical question and not a medical one. When you're talking about the medical side of it, you're talking about something about the conditions at the time of death. In other words, what is the state of the body at a time in which a person is dead, which is a different question than what death actually is, which we'll see here in just a minute. So we have to ask our question. The question is, what is the essence of death? We must first ask ourselves, okay, death is the absence of life, so we have to ask what life is. And life is defined differently, but philosophically it's pretty much the same. It is defined as an immanent, which means it's in the individual, it's something in the thing. It's an immanent activity within a thing. It's an activity of some sort. It's the ability in a nature, form, or power to move itself towards its own good. So in other words, each thing that is alive is ordered towards getting those things necessary to maintain its own existence. It's the substantial form proper to a nature that has living acts, is another way that it's sometimes defined. And this requires a bit of a digression, because if we're talking about what life actually is, that it's an immanent activity in a thing, then we have to know exactly what's the source of that activity, etc. The digression we need to make is the difference between form and matter, because there's, I think, it's a philosophical discussion, and then the material side, the material dispositional side, which is really what medicine deals with, which we'll talk about a little bit later, is the question that the medical community has to really come to terms with, to grapple with. The form, the definition of a form is what makes matter be what it is. In other words, it's the form of a dog that makes this particular matter be a dog. It's the form of a cat that makes this particular matter be a cat. And matter can be under a variety of different kinds of forms at different times. So the dog could eat the cat, so the matter that was part of the cat is now part of the dog. And so matter can be under, St. Thomas says, and Aristotle, under an infinite number of different forms. A form is the thing that makes matter be what it is. Because matter can be just about anything. You can put it together in all different kinds of combinations, etc. The form is not the shape, it's not its appearance. We're talking about the thing that actually makes this particular body be a human body as opposed to, a dog's body or something like that. This means, of course, that because the matter always exists under some kind of a form, that it's actually the form that communicates existence to the matter. In other words, matter is the type of thing that it can be practically anything, but it always exists under some form. And so the philosophers always noted that matter can only exist when it's under some kind of a form. So it's the form that communicates the existence that is the thing actually existing to the matter. Life is a specific kind of form. It is the form which makes the body living or confers life to the body. So in other words, it's not that the body is alive and then somehow or another there's some form that kind of moves it around or will it kind of gets it. That was Descartes' kind of a theory. That is actually contrary to the Catholic teaching. The Catholic Church teaches in the Council, I think it's Council of Orange, although don't quote me on that, but it's, or Vienna, sorry, the Council of Vienna, states that the soul is the substantial form of the body. And so it's not just that there's the soul independently existing from the body and somehow or another there's some place where they meet. Descartes thought it was the pituitary gland, but we can amuse ourselves later about that. But the point is that it's not that it just kind of moves the body around here and there. That's not exactly how it is. It's the two constitute a single thing. This special kind of form we call the soul, that is, it communicates life to the body, and there are two kinds of soul, one which they call immaterial soul and one which they call material. Animals are material souls because they, when they die, they just simply go out of existence and that's it. Whereas human beings have an immaterial soul, that is, their form that informs their matter is something that's spiritual or immaterial. And once it dies, then the form continues to exist even though the matter begins to decompose, etc. And the reason we know that there are that the, our soul or our form is something that's immaterial is because there are certain activities that we perform as human beings that are completely immaterial and not tied to matter as such. For example, making a free act of choice. If choice was a material activity, it would be determined by physical laws. And that's not always, you know, whereas free choice is the ability to choose between one thing or another freely without being determined. And so that's one of the reasons we know that it's not something that's actually material. There's certain acts of the intellect that we perform that are not in a physical thing. So, for example, to discuss the nature of truth or beauty or to contemplate that, while it might require the brain for its activities in order to be able to do that, there's certain operations it does independently of the body. So that's one of the reasons. So the form, we know it's immaterial because there's certain activities, and those activities always have to exist in something. In other words, you don't have, it's not like you have free choice walking down the street type of thing, or just floating down the street. It always, it's in something. Activities are always in something. So the soul is defined as a substantial form of the body, and it's the principle of life. It's the thing that gives life to the body. Therefore, death is defined as the separation of the soul from the body. In other words, the principle of life leaves the body, and then the body is actually dead. The form, St. Thomas says, form is the thing that, again, a thing that is alive. It's ordering certain things towards its own perfection, and by perfection we mean that it can continue functioning, it eats, so that it can exist and it can reproduce and things of that sort. It's ordered towards its own operations, which means it's the thing that keeps the body unified, ultimately. Why? You remove the soul, the body decomposes. And so it's the soul that's the principle of unity. This is a very important point because in some of the medical literature, and even in this article, they were trying to assert that... You can bring the food.
Okay, thank you.
They were trying to assert that the brain was the integrating organ of the body. And as you'll see as a little bit later, there is no such thing as an integrating organ of the body. The integrating principle, the thing that keeps the whole thing alive and moving and as a unified thing, is actually the soul, the form, which makes this body be a human body. St. Thomas says that form in all things, whether it's living or dead, form is the principle of unity as it directs its activities towards the ends for which it is ordered. So it's the one that maintains the body as a single unit, keeps it from disintegrating, etc. The medical profession as such, now here we're not talking about medical doctors who have a philosophical background, but the medical profession as such, does not have the ability to define death, but only the conditions at the time of death, because what death is a question of essence, that is, what, which gets to the essence, which falls in the domain of philosophy. Whereas the medical field will actually deal with not what is the essence of death, but what are the conditions present in the body, and that conditions, that is the disposition of the body, we call the material disposition. So the form informs the matter according to this material disposition. So that requires a little bit of a discussion on exchange of forms. Now, I don't know if we want to kind of pause there or what we want to do. Yeah.
Well, I have a question.
Yeah.
Maybe it's a good time to pause. How is it possible then to tell if there's a defect of the form or a defect of the matter? Because the material of the brain of a dog...
Right.
Is not informed by its soul the way it does not have the abilities that our brain does, primarily because of the difference in form,
right.
Not necessarily the difference in matter.
Right.
But when you see a Down syndrome child or somebody that has been traumatized in some way,
right.
We presume that that's a defect in the matter, but is there any way to say that they're conclusively that that's the case? Could it not be a defect in the form?
To answer your question, just initially, no. But it can't be a defect in form. But that requires me to get into a little bit more about the material dispositions. Because the soul operates, the activities of the soul occur through the body, but it requires the proper dispositions on the side of the body to perform its activities. So what can happen is a defect on the side of the material disposition can block the soul's ability to act through it properly. So, unless you guys want to eat and I can eat afterwards and I can just go continue.
Okay.
It would be good.
Yeah, we don't want to get too far into it.
We don't want your soup to get cold.
Yeah.
He was the pacer at this. Nice guy.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's wonderful because you have to trade one addiction for another.
Yeah.
That's all right. A good one.
So we're ready?
We're on.
Yep.
Okay.
Father, could I just impose on you just to sort of recap the first half?
In 2 minutes or less? In two sentences. Okay, so basically death is a philosophical question, what it is. It's really the separation of the form from the body that is the soul from the body. And it depends upon the material disposition of the body, basically, which is what I'm going to talk about right now. Okay. So St. Thomas says that a form, and this would include the soul, cannot inform the matter, that is, it cannot act through it and make it be a particular type of being, unless the matter is properly disposed, which is applicable to the human being as well. He says that the material disposition is not merely a conglomeration of elements, so it's not just a matter of putting a bunch of chemicals together. This is a commonly held opinion today, and it lacks philosophical understanding. Rather, the soul informs the matter. When one form leaves the matter, another enters, and this process is called corruption and generation. So I'm going to explain a little bit about what that process is. The first substantial form had various qualities or dispositions necessary for the subsequent form. The qualities of the matter pass during this process and exist under one form in the beginning, and then once it's taken into the individual, then it exists under that form, that is another one, in the end. What St. Thomas is guarding against is the idea that matter does not have a substantial form residing in it. In other words, that it can kind of exist on its own without having form. And also the idea that elements remain elements in the body after they're taking it in. So in other words, once you eat something, it actually becomes part of you. You can get a microscope and isolate it by visually and that type of thing, but the fact of the matter is that it's actually doesn't exist on its own. It exists as an accidental quality inside of you now. Because an element is a substance, that is, when it exists on its own, once it becomes part of the body, it ceases existing on its own and is now metaphysically, that is, in a philosophical sense, called an element, that is, becomes part of our body. The point to bear in mind is that although at times St. Thomas will say that the elements compose the matter for the form, he does not mean that they remain elements as such in the modern empirical sense. In other words, it's not hydrogen and oxygen existing on their own type of thing. We're talking about something that has the accidental qualities of hydrogen and oxygen existing in our bodies. The necessity of this disposition is from the axiom which states that everything that is received according to the mode of the receiver. In other words, we as human beings determine how we end up taking things into our bodies. Even when we ingest them, our body determines how we actually take it in and not. The disposition in the matter prior to animation, now animation is a distinction. Prior to the advent of modern science, they used to make a distinction between conception and animation. Conception was the time in which the gametes would actually meet, but they would say it took a little bit of time because they just didn't understand the science well enough, and they didn't understand what they were looking at well enough, but they said animation, that is, when the soul is infused, occurred much later. Now today we know that's not the case, but I don't want to get into all that at this point. I just want to make this observation, that the disposition in the matter prior to animation, for example, at the time of conception, is caused by the composition of the elements, which are the material cause of the body. but the elements do not remain elements once they become part of the body of the human being. St. Thomas says, though, in his commentary on Aristotle's De Anima, that the elements are not totally corrupted, but their power remains, as Aristotle says. And this is insofar as the proper acts of the elements remain according to some mode in which the power of the elements remain. What does this mean? It means when I take in oxygen, it ceases being oxygen as such, but the accidental qualities of oxygen now become part of my body, and my body uses it in that manner. For Aquinas, the elements do not corrupt in the sense that they cease to be substances existing on their own, but their accidental qualities or powers remain in the exchange of forms. So once it goes from being under the form of oxygen, it now comes under the form of a human being, although the accidental qualities, you know, like how it bonds chemically and things of that, or, you know, on an atomic level and things of that sort, that remains as part of the accidental qualities that are passed over into the body. But their accidental qualities or powers remain in the exchange of forms. The newly generated form then assumes or takes on these active qualities. So basically what it means is this. If I eat corn, so I walk up to some guy's plant and I just peel it off and I eat the corn, right? I change the material disposition of the matter which was under the form of corn by eating it. And those accidental qualities that once existed under the form of corn now exist under a human form in me. That is, they're under the, basically under the activity of the human soul. Now, and when we're talking about this, St. Thomas makes the observation that prior to one form leaving, and so like, say, in the case of death, and then another form entering, because matter is always under some form, there's always it's kind of like a hyperbolic curve type of a thing. The material disposition begins to decay. And it gets to a certain point where the form that is informing that can't continue acting and moving through that that material disposition, because it gets to such a stage that it can't act through it anymore. And once it gets to that stage, then that form, where it can no longer act through it, then that form ceases to be, and then the next form comes in immediately after that, and then it begins adjusting the matter, rearranging the matter according to its own disposition so that it can act, the form itself can act optimally through the body. So once the new form enters, this form begins the process of arranging the matter for its operations so that it can do this. For example, at conception, when the male gamete penetrates the wall of the female gamete, there's a rapid series of chemical events that have as their finality a fully functional human being. So once one gamete penetrates the other, the material disposition of the female gamete changes to such a degree that it ceases being a female gamete. And as such, there is a change of forms. In other words, the soul is infused at that time. And this new form is called the soul. And the reason we know this at the time of conception is because the soul acts through it. What's its activity? It's what they call the augmentative power. It's the power of growth. There is a singular linear trajectory, even though there's a variety of different things that are happening on that, from the time of conception until the time of a child, and even beyond that, up until the person's a full-blown human being. So that we know that the soul is present at the time of conception because of the fact that this augmentation, this growth begins, that process begins, and there's a linear trajectory. All these chemical changes throughout a living body are driven by the form for its operations. In other words, it tries to arrange the matter to the degree that it can for its operations. When there are no operations, in other words, once the matter becomes incapable of sustaining any operation, then the thing is dead. This means that because there can be a variety of chemical dispositions, and because people can live without a certain functioning organs for a short period of time, it tells us that no one organ is the integrating principle of the body or the cause of life in the individual. Rather, it's a number of them together.
Can you repeat that for me?
Yeah. All these chemical changes throughout a living body are driven by the form for its operation. So it tries to arrange that. When there are no operations, it's dead. Okay. This means that because there can be a variety of chemical dispositions, in other words, at a certain stage, a person may not be fully dead because other operations of the soul are continuing, even though one of the organs has shut down. Okay. So that being the case, people can live without certain functioning organs for a short period of time. It tells us that no one organ is the integrating principle of the body or the cause of life as such. This is where the article gets it wrong, if you read that article. The brain is not the integrating principle. The soul is the principle of unity, therefore it is the integrating principle of the body or human being. It is true that we cannot live without the brain for a very long period of time, obviously. But the same can be said of the heart, or the cardiovascular system. In fact, if medical assistance is not applied, there are numerous organs. Once they cease functioning, the person will die. And the rate in which one dies depends upon the particular organ or organs we are talking about. The brain just happens to be one of those organs that we cannot live for very long without it. But we are getting ahead of ourselves at this stage. How do we know that if the brain ceases functioning, the person is still alive? First, since the brain is not the principle of life and the soul is, as long as the soul is present, the person is alive. How do we know that the soul is present? Through its activities. In the case of the person approaching death, the soul can continue to function through the body as long as a minimal amount of material disposition is present for just one of its activities. But once the soul is gone, the person is truly dead because the principle of life is not present. That is, there's no minimal activity proper to a human being as such. Now, there's different activities of the soul, and these activities are acts of faculties. So you have the soul, which is the form, it's the thing that makes us be human, along with our body. And then you have faculties, and there's two kinds of faculties, as I mentioned. There's those that are immaterial and those that are material, because they're a composite of an immaterial component and a material component. This faculty is just the ability of the soul to act through the body. Some through the body as in a composite organ, or some purely immaterial. So the faculties are broken into five categories philosophically. The first is the nutritive faculty. And the nutritive faculty doesn't pertain to one particular organ. It can be a number of different organs coming together to do that function. Then there is the augmentative faculty. That's a faculty that gives the ability to grow and to heal. Then actually healing is a process of both the nutritive and the augmentative. Then there's the appetitive faculty. This would include things like emotions and things of this sort. There's the locomotive faculty, ability to move. And then the intellective faculty, which includes a three-pole, from the scholastic understanding of it, there's three parts to the actual human mind. There's two immaterial parts, one which has the capacity for judgment, one which has the capacity for abstraction, the other one which is a physical thing, that's what the brain is, which has the capacity for images and memory and things of this sort. And that comes together to constitute a single faculty. As long as one of these faculties is operative through the body, the soul is present because the nutritive faculty, for example, and the other faculties are properly human faculties. What does this mean? It means that St. Thomas makes the observation that human senses, like touch, is distinctly different. It's only analogically like an animal's, because we as human beings are actually experiencing this thing as an activity of the soul, which is immaterial, which for them is not immaterial. So it's a very distinctive kind of thing. And we actually even know this too, because we know that the material disposition of the sense, our senses, is different from animals, just by the genetic code and things of that sort. So, actually, we know this from modern medical science and practice. For example, the nutritive faculty, the GI tract, can shut down, but you can keep the person alive through IVs. The augmentative faculty can shut down because a person can stop growing or healing. The appetitive faculty can shut down because people can keep be unconscious but alive and have no emotional life. The locomotive faculty can shut down because there can be certain drugs where they can be administered to the person. They're completely conscious, but they can't move. We also know that the intellective can be there, and this is where brain death kind of fits in. Now, Pius XII makes a statement that is extremely important for understanding this whole discussion, I think. He said, in 1957, he said, quote, "But considerations of a general nature allow us to believe that human life continues for as long as vital functions, distinguished from the simple life of organs, manifest themselves spontaneously or even with the help of artificial processes." Okay, now let me read that again and then we'll kind of parse it out a little bit. But considerations of a general nature allow us to believe that human life continues as long as its vital functions, distinguished from this simple life of organs, manifest themselves spontaneously or even with the help of artificial processes. In other words, what he's saying is you can have particular function or particular organs shut down and the person can still be alive. That's basically what he's saying. So from that, we recognize that the death of a single organ, or even some organs, does not necessarily constitute death of the individual.
Father, can you read that one more time?
Yeah, from Pius XII.
Yes.
But considerations of a general nature allow us to believe that human life considers for as long as its vital functions, distinguished from the simple life of organs, manifest themselves spontaneously or even with the help of artificial processes.
Distinguished from the simple life of organs.
Organs, right.
What does that mean?
It means that you can have one like, say, your kidneys can shut down. That doesn't mean you're dead. Because there's other vital functions that are still occurring. And so what he's saying, and that's why it's important to recognize that the death of one organ doesn't constitute death of the whole individual. Now, normally, once a particular, like if the brain dies, the guy's going to be dead in short order, because the vital functions are going to shut down pretty quick. Even when you're trying to keep them alive for a certain while, putrefaction sets in, etc. But the point is that you just have to recognize that just because one organ shuts down doesn't, or a few, doesn't mean the person's dead, because there can still be vital functions, and by that we mean the soul can still be operating through the body.
How do you determine whether it's a vital function that's being determined by the action of the soul versus...
Give me just a minute. That's a good question, though. Therefore, we come to the issue of brain death. Part of the difficulty is when you read not the medical literature so much, as when you read the legal literature about brain death, it's all over the map. I mean, the person can have just a small part of the brain dead, other ones, the whole thing has to be dead. There's a creeping... In the legal sphere, there's a creep to require less and less and less brain death in order to harvest the organs. And that's the problem. In fact, there was one state, I think it might have been Connecticut, they said the person doesn't even have to be brain dead. Death just has to be imminent. So I asked a physician, what does that mean? Yeah, what does that mean? I said, how long is imminent? He says, within the year.
Oh,
yeah, so this is the
slippery slope.
We all was here.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. There is a... Okay, so...
Given our predictive ability, yeah.
So it seems to me that true medical criteria must be developed in order to determine when a person is truly dead. In other words, we need to talk about what constitutes a vital function. And then the second thing is what those vital functions are, and then from there we can say, okay, these vital functions are missing and now the person can be declared dead. There is a gamut due to the discussion of the disposition of the body as it approaches change of forms. There are different points along the curve. So if you remember that curve where the bodily disposition begins to change and then the person dies and then a new form, and basically once a person dies, you basically become a conglomeration of elements, basically, elements in the modern sense. They had to have an accidental unity, and the reason we know that is after short order, it just decomposes, right? Okay. There is a gamut due to this discussion of the disposition of the body as it approaches this change of forms. In other words, you're talking about at what point does the change actually occur in the bodily dispositions? There are points along the curve that we know the person is alive. You know, they're talking to us and they're coherent, etc. There are parts where we know they're dead. So, for example, when rigor sets in, they're dead. Okay. Then there's points that there is... Then there's points where there is true intellectual doubt because we do not see the soul directly and therefore cannot know with absolute certainty when it leaves. In other words, we can get... The criteria as clear as we possibly can, but at the actual moment, there's always going to be a bit of uncertainty on our part of knowing the exact instance. But there will be some criteria that can be met medically that will give us an indication, okay, we can have certitude that this person's dead. Now, this brings up a very important point. The church, as well as the entire moral tradition of the church, states that when there is doubt of fact, you do not act. Now, let me give you an example. That's the general principle. So, for example, if I go hunting and I see a bush rustle, and I stick my gun in there and pull the trigger, even though I don't know what's in there, right? I'm acting on doubt. I don't know what's on that doubt that it could be, you know. And so the next thing I know is my best friend just kind of, you know, lies out on the ground and bleeds to death, right? Okay. Because of the doubt, you're not permitted to act. Now, there's what they call doubt of law, which is distinct from doubt of fact. Doubt of law is that reasonable men do not really know what the law actually states. But we know what the law states because God said it, and we know it by the natural law, which is you cannot commit murder. Right. So we know that you can't take someone's life. In the case of, like, medically, and I'll talk a little bit about that in just a minute to how to sort some of that out if you want me to. So then the question becomes, then you have to be at a stage where you are morally certain, and by morally means that medically it's clear the person is dead, before you can start taking the person's organs. And here we're talking about, of course, those that are untwinnable or can't or are not twinned by nature. So we're talking about those that, you know, that can't be twinned. Yeah.
So you made an important distinction by saying that you had to be certain according to medical knowledge.
Yes.
As opposed to philosophical knowledge.
Well, because the philosophical knowledge is, the certainty we have of philosophical knowledge is, death occurs when the soul leaves the body. But that's all that philosophy can say.
Right.
To actually say at what stage the vital functions shut down, you have to take, obviously, because the soul is acting through the body, you know that as a principle, but what constitutes a vital function is really, even though philosophy would say this contributes to life and that wouldn't, medicine is going to be the one to say, these particular vital functions at this stage have shut down or they have not.
But if it is also true at the same time that the best you can ever expect for medical certainty is probable certainty, then what do you do with that?
Then you have to err on the side of the certainty.
Because all of our certainty in medicine, I would say virtually all of it, is probable certainty.
Yeah.
Because it's not pure science. It's not like mathematics.
Right.
So
it is an art, to some degree.
But yeah. You have to make a judgment based on probable certainty, and it may be very probable. It may be...
Right.
If you try to express it mathematically, it may be better than 99.9%.
Right, and I think, though, that there is... Right. When you're talking about the individual case...
So,
right.
Morally speaking, though, is it sufficient... to operate from probable certainty?
Well, let me just back up just a minute. I think that medical criteria, objective, empirical criteria can be met about what constitutes a vital function and what doesn't. Applying that in the concrete, coming to knowledge of that, is a different matter. So I think that the criteria can be developed, how it's going to be applied in the concrete is where the art kicks in. And there you still have to operate on certitude. Moral certitude. Moral certitude.
What is moral certitude? Moral certitude, certainly would be the opposite.
Right, exactly.
And that's what we offer now. Moral certitude.
Yeah.
You don't have absolute.
Say that again. Moral certitude is.
Moral certitude is acting on the. You're as certain as you can be without the opposite.
Right. Yeah, yeah, I think so. Whereas. Physical certitude or absolute certitude would be, you know, I am physically, so I'm absolutely certain you're here. You know, it's not some, there's no doubt in my mind, unless you're Descartes or someone like that.
we operate on most of our operations.
Yes. Yes. So,
See, what Father Chav's example is shooting the bush. See, where the fallacy of where the man was wrong is because he was not morally certain that the bush was truly a deer.
Right, exactly. Right. So.
Well, most of medicine, you know, you see a child with pneumonia, you have, you know, a certain moral certitude that this child has pneumonia, and based on your training and medical literature, it's most likely, you know, we'll say strep pneumo, so you're going to pick, you know, Augmentin to treat it or whatever.
Yeah.
Well, then he ends up having something else. Well, did you do something wrong because you
not
chose
moral.
That antibiotic? No, not
well,
morally.
Right, so yeah. That's why there's certain medical treatments that, you know, as long as you're trying to do the best you can, you're working within the range of the science, you're acting justly in relationship
and so,
with the person.
And so in Idaho, there's actually a standard of care for legality.
Right.
If you are following the standard of care in your particular field, you cannot even be held legally responsible for poor outcome.
Right.
As long as you acted in good faith and done what was, you know.
Right, but when you're talking about something that by its nature is going to bring about the death of an individual, you're talking about something that's inherently moral.
Mm-hmm.
So when you're talking about a medical procedure, like if you're talking about harvesting a person's organs, which is going to take their life, you've got to be—you have to be morally certain that person is dead,
mm-hmm.
and that's where the real kicker, I think, lies. So if I can just kind of finish up, and then I can answer some questions if you want, or we can discuss it. I have it's somewhat of a proposal. It seems to me that as long as the person is breathing, even if it's not on his own or taking in nutrients in the various organs, albeit not all of them, the nutritive faculty is present and therefore the person is alive. Even when the heart stops beating for a while, the person's heart can be jump-started and the person can continue living. Therefore, it seems to me that the cessation of the heart is not the criteria because the soul can continue some activities in the nutritive faculty for a short period of time after the heart is stopped. And that also would avoid, that particular criteria would also avoid the problem of you know, well, if the heart stopped, then you'd leave the killer, the person's dead, but then you can start them again and now they're alive again. No, actually, the soul would still be there operating to the degree it can until other functions within the individual completely get to the point where it can't operate anymore. So, therefore, it seems to me that there must be a point at which, after the heart is stopped and the nutritive faculty is stopped in various organs, that at that moment, the lowest activity of the soul, and normally its last, ceases. That is the medical criteria that must be sought, and that will give an authentic criteria of medical death will be one that takes that into account, it seems to me. But that's something that I'm open to discussion. That's just a proposal.
You're saying all five faculties have to be gone.
All five faculties have to be gone, because otherwise the soul is present because it's operating through the body.
You're saying the nutritive faculty is still present even if artificial ventilation is occurring?
Yeah.
Because oxygen is being brought into the body?
Right. Because it doesn't pertain just to the lungs. Yeah, the other mechanisms within the body are still functioning in relationship to that.
It may be an extraordinary care. That's a totally different question. It's just
right.
that the body is still alive.
Right.
Yeah. Right.
See, that's why I think that line from Pius XII is so key. It's not a matter of what organ is shutting down or what have you. It's, is the activities of the soul still present in some way?
Okay. So if you have a person who is now on a ventilator and is receiving various medications to keep the heart going,
mm-hmm.
their blood pressure is, they have a blood pressure, because oxygen is being metabolized?
Yes.
How is that different than taking an organ and giving appropriate metabolism to an organ to keep an organ alive in a laboratory?
Well, because of the principle of unity. So it gets to your question about that, because once you take the organ out of the individual, it ceases being informed by his soul.
Okay.
And it's now existing on its own as a conglomeration of accidents. And those, remember, that's why I said the accidental qualities remain afterwards, so the thing's going to continue functioning afterwards for a while, obviously.
Right.
But then you might go a little bit further and say that it's just an accidental difference between the case where the organ is removed and it's in the laboratory and where the organ is in the body and being artificially sustained by all this equipment. Accidental in the sense that the unitive principle is no longer there. So, for example, if you say that the potential of a faculty, mm-hmm. the operative, is dependent upon the activity of the soul.
The disposition of the body.
Or if you talk in terms of there will be some situations where you would have to say, yes, there is an operation here, but the potential for it to be sustained by the unitive principle of the soul has been lost. In other words, the only reason we're able to oxygenate tissue, the principle of sustaining oxygenation of the tissue,
right,
has been completely divorced from the presence of soul and is entirely dependent upon manipulation of equipment.
Well,
so the unitive principle for that particular faculty is no longer the soul, it's a machine.
No, I don't think so.
Are you saying it's unitive because it's still in the body?
Yeah. And in other words, the fact that the organ is in the body means that it's actually part of my body. And when you put somebody on a set of machines, the machines don't go into every individual cell and cause them to take in the oxygen and that type of thing. It just supplies the oxygen to a particular organ so that it can continue providing that function.
Right.
So the point is that the soul can still be operative in some of the other parts of the body, even though that particular organ itself isn't going on its own, so to speak.
I guess if you were to really draw an extravagant example, you could visualize somebody on the side of this body saying, "Okay, the soul's here. Click, soul's gone. Click, soul's back here. Click, soul's gone."
No, but that's just exactly my point, is there comes a certain point where throughout the body as a whole, none of the faculties can function.
But the actual potential for the faculty to function has been completely divorced at this point when you're in control of the switch, has been divorced from the unitive principle of the soul, it seems.
No, what's the only thing that you're doing in that particular case is you're determining the actual material disposition, the maintenance and the material disposition. That's what you're doing with the switch.
Why does brain death equal death if you have, you know, ventilators and everything keeping somebody otherwise alive?
Because other faculties of the soul are still operating.
So that you're not dead.
So you're not dead.
So brain death doesn't equal death.
Right. Now, it's going to be short order. It's going to be death. I mean, in most people, they're going to be dead in short order. It was these considerations, and as well as some medical ones, which is why 400 philosophers, theologians, medical doctors, and people in medical personnel signed a petition to the Holy Father and said this criteria has to be seriously reviewed and brought into, you know, and because of the fact that it doesn't really wash philosophically, it doesn't really wash... in some cases, medically, although I think, you know, as far as whether the person is using brain death according to some of the legal criteria. So there was, you know, serious discussion that this needs to be addressed. Now, the Holy Father read it, recognized something did need to be said, which is why when he did put out his document or made his allocution, he was very careful to make sure that he didn't equate brain death with death. And he was very careful to say that you can take a person's organs once you're certain they're dead. But he didn't determine what that certainty of death was.
That's the kicker right there.
Exactly.
When are you truly sure that a person is truly dead, and then therefore you can harvest the organs?
There he goes, right.
But then again, we are talking again about moral certainty rather than...
Right.
That's right. As certain as you can be.
Yeah.
But Father Ripper agrees. Point is, this is different than probably all other medical decisions you make because it's cessation of life, and so you have to have moral certitude, not
right,
not.
But moral certainty is still going to be at best kind of probabilistic rather than mathematical.
But he's making the argument that if there's any of the faculties are present, then there's not certitude.
See, it seems to me, too, like the criteria for brain death has its place, not in the sense of determining that the person's actually dead, but determining whether extraordinary means has to be continued or not.
Well, that's because death is imminent, and death. There's no person that's ever survived those criteria.
I would say that as a practical matter, that the vast majority of times I get consulted, that in fact is the issue rather than... By many times. I mean,
yeah.
But none of us at this table will ever be asked to harvest organs. but we may be asked to certify brain death. And we can do that with and sort of keep ourselves out of the discussion of whether or not it's appropriate to harvest organs. I mean, I've always avoided that in my training and in my field because I'm very uncomfortable at that state of a patient's life or death.
But some of us are involved. You know, we have a niece who's a surgery tech, and she may be involved in the harvesting of organs. And so she needs to have the certainty that she's doing this with a dead person.
And, right.
Well, there really
or our
there
children
really is
that are in
no,
medical school that will be on the transplant team.
There, if you follow Father Ripper's arguments, then there's really no way to be certain with anybody on life support that they're dead.
Yeah, basically.
Because they'll have, in order to be a candidate for harvest, they'll have their nutrients.
So would you, you say then, Father, that if we are ever to be able to say with certainty that a person is dead and therefore capable of being an organ donor, that they at least would have to be, no longer be on life support?
At least, yeah.
So anyone on life support...
I mean, well, just think what you just said, life support. Do you know what and they talk that way even about in the harvesting teams,
well,
huh?
I mean,
they'll sit there and they'll say, keep the body alive.
Yeah. The organ's alive. Yeah. Or you could call
because,
it organ
well,
support.
You might, but
I mean, you
in
could...
there, not to defend them too much, because
yeah.
I've been sort of struck by a certain sense of a macabre when these people come through.
Mm-hmm.
But,
it's a big business.
Really, I mean, there's a weird, it just sort of struck me as group that comes through that just struck me as awfully cavalier. But anyway, that's neither here nor there.
So
the point I have is that in defense of the argument, not your argument, but the other argument, say that there would be conditions under which you could proceed with certainty, even in the face of life or
organ
want to describe that. If somebody were to make a convincing argument that the unitive principle is no longer the soul, I suppose that they could prevail in the argument, right?
That's why they, in fact, in the article, they kept trying to assert that the brain was the principle of unity, and it's not. And that's the whole point, because and that's where the whole discussion of what the soul actually is and the fact that it gives life to the body. And that it unifies as a form, because the form always unifies the matter into a single being. It's the principle of unity. But you're right. If you could, if they could argue the opposite and show that, then they could. The problem is that if you take a realistic philosophical approach, you can't argue that.
I have a question.
Yeah.
If you are the recipient of a vital organ,
mm-hmm.
heart, lung, blood. I'm talking about you need to keep someone on life support in order to harvest that organ.
Right.
And if you are the recipient of that organ, can you receive an organ like that in good faith? I mean,
that's a real touchy issue.
I mean, I can't see if you philosophically believe this.
Right.
Yeah.
How can you accept someone's organs?
You have to make restitution from the guy you took them from. Except there's one exception, and that is, because recently the Vatican has made the statement that the state does have a right to capital punishment, but they don't want it being done as frequently as often. Now that being the case. If a person was guilty of a truly capital crime and it was such a type of thing, then you could legitimately say, you know, if he was being put to death under perfectly legitimate circumstances, because I'm trying to avoid the China issue.
Yes, exactly.
So if that person was, then you could say your capital punishment is to basically to be an organ donor.
Oh, that's really
now, I'm not suggesting that.
Yeah, I know.
Because then all of a sudden what constitutes... a capital crime will start changing all of a sudden. But
it's consistent with your argument, though, for sure.
Yeah. That would be the only time in which it would be permitted. Yeah. And in a situation like that, you could receive the organ, I think. Yeah.
So match in that way.
Yeah, because with organ donation, you've got to go keep the organ alive.
Yeah.
And you're saying, okay, that as long as the organ is alive, the donor, then there's the soul is still animal.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, it's sort of like, if you look at the, if you make an analogy between the soul and a bicycle rider, let's say, or a bicycle rider
in like that one?
In relation to the movement of a bicycle. Yeah.
Wait, do you mind if I shut my recording off at this point?
I mean, normally the bicycle is pushed along by the rider, right?
Right.
But it's perfectly capable. We're perfectly capable to move that bicycle along without being the rider.
That's
and
right.
And the principle of unity, in the case, as far as the motion of the bicycle is concerned, you can take the bicycle from point A to point B. Either the rider on it as the principle of motion, or somebody else. And the soul, as the unit of principle, is like the rider who pushes that bicycle along as the integrating feature or principle for the whole process of motion. But in so-called life support, where a judgment is made, well, the soul is no longer the unitive or propelling force, the body's being pushed along just in the same way that we're pushing the bicycle along the road.
Not exactly.
I mean, but that...
That's
I mean,
an analogy, but
the
analogy...
That's argument that would have
right.
to be made.
Yes, but the, right, and, but the analogy fails in this. The soul, as the form of the body, is throughout all of the body. In the case of the rider, he is not the same thing as the bike.
Well, yeah, yeah, okay, the analogy's not perfect.
No, but that, but it's precisely in that difference, which is why a mechanical thing, you know, functions one way, and a living thing functions another. Because one is under the substantial form of a living, of a soul that causes it to be alive, and the other one is merely the product of its inner physical interactions of physics, basically.
Yeah, but you might say that in the case of the body that's fully informed by the soul, the potential for any of the faculties to operate is exclusively tied to the presence of the soul.
Ultimately, yes.
But in the case of the tissue explant that's mm-hmm. in the laboratory, it's functioning the same way it would in the body.
Right.
There's clearly a different principle of unity and a principle
I don't think
of vitalization.
I don't think there is, because the point in fact is that you can't keep that organ alive without the other without basically the faculties of the soul moving to the other parts of the body in order to maintain that thing.
Well, there are certain cell lines. There's a cervical cancer cell line that is still living in 1958 called the HeLa cell line. And those cells in the laboratory, they use them for research, continue to grow and grow and grow. As long as they're given the nutrient, they just
they've already been separated. No, but they've been right. They've been exactly. They've been separated from the body.
But any organ that's explanted and sustained like that in the laboratory is
right. But once it's separated from the body, let me back up. The human being constitutes a composite. We're a single substance composed of body and soul together.
Right.
So if you take things out of that and the soul is still present, that ceases being part of my body. So, for example, if I chop my finger off, you know, it's no longer part of my body unless one of you guys happen to sew it on for me. But the point is, and then what happens is once that happens, then the soul animates that part of the body again. So it's the same thing if you do a transplant, that the soul does inform that particular part of the body that's been transplanted.
Okay.
But the point is once it's taken out, or once parts are taken off, they're no longer alive in the sense that, I mean, we say it alive because of the fact that they behave somewhat the same way. That's those accidental qualities
right.
I mentioned, as they do when they're in the body. But that, what we're talking, once you separate it from the body, they are substantially different.
now. This one is no longer under the composite. The other one is something existing on its own.
Well, yeah, and I guess the argument then would be if there's any way to justify doing organ harvesting, you have to be able to make the argument that the function of those organs is no longer tied to the unit of principle.
Right, yeah, you would have to make that argument.
But that's the hard thing. You see, we're blocked, turn off the machine, okay? And that's the moral dilemma.
Right.
How quote, alive is the person on the machine?
Well, have we created a lab where essentially the organ, being the remainder of the body besides the brain, is kept alive in the lab? You could take out the liver and put it in a lab, and it's not being animated by the soul.
Right.
And you could take the guts here, and you could take the skin here, and you could separate it, you could part them all out,
right,
and they would not be part of the...
Right.
They would not be unity.
Right.
But if they're all together...
They still enjoy that unity.
You would have to make the argument that essentially, well, in reality, that they're being kept alive entirely by the lab environment. It's accidental that they are together.
Actually, they're not being kept alive entirely. What's keeping the thing alive is the presence of the soul. What you're providing is the material input into that to keep the soul to be able to function at a minimal level.
But that's arguable. You could say that it's not really the soul because it's simply the fact that you're... offering that particular thing which allows them in a laboratory environment to stay alive.
But there's vital functions that are still occurring that you yourself are not directly causing through your intervention, only indirectly.
That's the same as if in our lab there's things that are happening that you're not directly causing.
True.
Like they have a nutritive faculty in a lab?
No. But it's one of those, again, it's one of those things that we're back to the whole issue of the unity. Mm-hmm. If the soul is still there, then it's exercising its... it's a principle of unity over the thing, and it's still exercising its functions. Once you separate those things out, those accidental qualities remain in those other things, and they can continue doing a lot of the things that they used to do in the body because of the accidental qualities.
Well, I think the argument that, in my mind, is most compelling is if you go to a conviction of murder, it has to be, if there's one doubt, if there's one person on the jury, they're innocent.
Right.
And... if there's any reasonable doubt that the soul is still in that unit, then you shouldn't agree to organ transplant.
Yeah.
What about turning off, shutting off the plug,
I think just the ordinary extraordinary means principles. I think they're well reasoned. I think they still apply, even though some theologians try to argue they don't apply anymore. But in my experience, and when I've had, because I've numerous times people have asked me, you know, this is where my husband is, do we have to continue this? And I'll just say, these are what you have to continue, this is what you don't, and it's up to you whether you want to do it or not.
And it seems like, at least at this point, it's pretty clear.
Yeah, I think it is.
Okay, thank you. Part of the brain death, I don't know if this is helpful for people or not, but part of these criteria, at least, is actually discontinuing the ventilator to ensure that, in fact, people are not breathing on their own.
Right.
To make sure that there's not...
Yeah, you have to stop for a few minutes and ensure their carbon dioxide rises a certain level.
I don't think there's ever been a moral dilemma taking a person on the ventilator because it seems extraordinary.
Yeah, exactly. I think could be some circumstances where it may not be. Like some kid, he's in the underwater, you pull him out and you put him on vent for a little while and then he's fine. That would probably be ordinary. But when you're talking about end-of-life situation, it's a whole different thing. Right.
And those are aggressive needs. I mean, because there's people that come in with drug overdoses.
Yeah.
That would meet the criteria for brain death.
Yeah.
Except they have a phenobarbital level that's astronomically high or something. You know what I mean? Or that they're hypothermic or something like that.
So you would go the extraordinary means to pull them out, try to pull them out of that situation.
Absolutely. This is all contingent on those things being tested for and people's body temperature being normalized and the drug screens being negative and all those things. Absolutely.
So if you determine someone is brain dead and you've taken them off of life support, is there a point at which, after you've taken them off life support, that you can then harvest the organs and it not be killing the person? And are the organs still harvestable?
Well, there's a whole slew of organs that are harvestable within 24 hours of death.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah,
that's...
Yeah, things like that.
Bone, and that gets to
skin.
That gets to my proposal, which is, okay, I can tell you what the principles are, but it's the medical community that has to apply those and say, these are the criteria that meet these principles that you state.
I mean, how long do you have to be off of life support to say you're dead? I mean, you're not breathing. You don't have a heart rate.
When all five faculties are gone.
Yeah.
Right.
I mean, that would be that. And, you know, when I pronounce death, it's usually during a code situation. You know, the kid comes in not breathing, not with a heart rate, and we've coded them for 20 minutes or so, and we just don't have anything come back, and so they're dead. I mean,
Nutritive faculties continue for days.
I have no question in my mind that child is dead.
Nutritive faculties continue for days.
Wait a minute. Why don't we discuss that with Father? Because here they have all the clinical evidence of death.
Yeah.
But they have some sort of nutritive faculty.
At a low level.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What is
I don't know if this is true, but fingernails grow after death. But for sure, on a microscopic level, there'll be cellular life probably for weeks if you include some of the more anaerobic parts of our body.
Well, it's kind of interesting because, you know, not that I necessarily am going to solve this problem for you, but it seems to me that you know, in the past, the church used to say you could anoint someone conditionally between 45 minutes and up to 2 hours even after they were dead.
Yeah.
Or pronounced dead, you know, cessation of cardiopulmonary activity. So it seems to me that there was probably some wisdom, somebody got the grave somewhere to kind of set that timeline. Yeah. Now, what that really means on a medical level, I can't really tell you. I'm just telling you what the principles are. And I mean, if you have suggestions and that type of thing, I can tell you whether I think they meet the principles or not. But that's about it.
Well, I would say, the declaration of the time of death is really inconsequential on a moral level.
Yeah.
I mean, whether you pronounce them dead at 6 p.m. or 6 p.m. the next day,
no, I know. Yeah.
It's over.
Yeah.
But harvesting of the organs we were talking about, like bone and skin stuff like that, that has no impact on the outcome.
Right.
So it probably is not a moral dilemma.
You mean taking parts that are...
Taking the corneas and taking the skin.
Yeah, those...
And somebody that's 24 hours dead, even though they may still have some nutritive...
Yeah. Well, and even... Yeah, that's right.
On a microscopic level in some corner of their body.
Right.
You're not accelerating any process like you would be in a organ harvest on somebody.
Yeah, that would just require the permission of next of kin.
Yeah.
Now, Father, I did hear on Audio Sancto, there's a priest that did talk about this topic, and he mentioned some guidelines that were issued on when a person can be embalmed.
Right.
In the 1950s, I don't know.
Yes. If I remember right, the when the person being embalmed is much later than it is, then we would probably be talking about when we think death would actually occur.
It's probably a similar idea.
Right. But
yeah.
Similar when you
can
Well, you know, in the hospital, you don't take them directly to the mortuary.
Right.
And they stay there for a little while?
Yeah.
Correct.
You're the morgue expert.
They go down. Yeah, they go to the morgue.
See, which would obviate ED moment.
Yeah. Right.
So, the Catholic Church has no stance on organ procurement?
The procurement, it just says, it basically says, based on the three different kinds of organs.
Sure, they're dead.
Twinnable and twinned organs, the person, through their own consent, can offer one of the organs. Right?
That makes sense.
But then when it comes to those which aren't, John Paul II, I think, set the criteria when he said the person has to be certainly dead before you can take them.
Great.
And that's just it. That's what the real issue is. But on the other hand, I don't think he was unwise in putting it that way. He sets the criteria, and then you have to give time for people to work the criteria out.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And of course, the whole person is certainly dead when the body starts to break down.
You're right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or when rigor, I would think rigor is clear.
Yeah. And that's pretty quickly.
Yeah.
One other thing, I'm not saying that this is convincing evidence, but it's just, I think it's unique in the body, is when people are brain dead, say, for instance, I mean, I've seen people who were met the criteria for brain death, and, you know, you would ventilate them, and, you know, their heart would look okay, or their kidneys would look okay, or their liver would look okay. But if someone's brain dead, their brain, if you operate on them, or if you do an immediate postmortem on them, their brain will, in fact, run out the hole. You know what I mean? I mean, it deteriorates despite any and all attempts to perfuse somebody if you're, in fact, truly brain dead.
Oh, there's lack of perfusion.
Yeah. I mean, with true brain death,
there's no blood
perfusion
flow
of any part of the brain whatsoever. And I mean, I've actually seen where somebody was still being ventilated and they wanted to biopsy the brain, and somebody that we thought was brain dead to find out why it happened. This is somebody who died under very unusual circumstances and was unclear what had happened to them. And when the attempt was made to drill a hole to do the biopsy, in fact, the contents of something came out. They were not cellular, man.
How long were they being sustained on the ventilator?
So was the brain like 12
years?
It was just necrotic, and it liquefied. I mean, it wasn't white in the sense of.
Yeah.
It actually hit under
the cheese, please.
Yeah. I think this
patient probably would have met. There was no. So here's one thing. In this particular case, because it was a young person and the circumstances was unclear, there was no attempt to make this person brain dead. You know what I mean? So it had not. It probably met the criteria.
Right.
But no one was going to harvest these organs because nobody knew what had happened to this young man.
Right.
And there was an attempt to do a biopsy on him to try to identify what had befallen this gentleman, to try to treat him. And just in point of fact, it had liquefied and it just came out and it was not really recognizable as cellular material even by the stomach.
Yeah. I think that kind of gets to my observation too, that there's certain organs, once they shut down, you're going to be dead in short order.
Right.
Well, one observation I had when I was involved as the ICU resident, trying to keep these bodies alive for a day for the organ procurement team from Cincinnati to come, is after pronunciation of brain death, it was very difficult to stabilize. The heart would misbehave, the lungs would misbehave. Any sort of rudimentary brain function kept our jobs a lot easier. But when they reached that point where they were brain dead, it was not an easy task to just keep them alive for a day. People say, oh, you can keep them on life support forever. That's really not the case. Everything is starting to
shut down.
I don't think that's really well understood, but that's
just an organ.
But it is still working. I mean,
there's
definitely... You're getting nutrition, and it's being tolerated, and the bowels are working, and the lungs are working.
Mm-hmm. But people that are, I think you point out, people that are truly, criteria for brain death, whatever that means, if they meet those criteria, those are not people that go to a nursing home and linger on.
Right, exactly.
That doesn't happen.
Right, we're talking about a matter of a couple of days.
I think the lay people don't know that
when
they discuss the target. Now, what are the five faculties again? I need to...
Nutritive. Augmentative.
So, nutritive is just nutrition. Or metabolism.
Metabolism, basically.
Augmentative is
growth.
Growth.
And those two together help you to heal.
Yep.
And then...
Does growth need to be categorized or clarified as to what true growth is?
It can be cellular growth. It can be growth on a variety of different levels, I think.
Okay.
So cellular regeneration?
And then appetitive.
What?
The appetitive.
Appetitive.
Appetites, emotions, that type of thing. Because for the scholastics, the emotions are what they call sensitive appetites. And then the locomotive, and then the intellective.
So really... When we have somebody that is brain dead,
you're dealing with the nutritive.
They have most of their things except the nutritive. That's the only faculty that persists.
Yeah. Because nothing else is going to continue.
Well,
maybe
I mean,
they can grow. Yeah.
Augmentative and nutritive persist. But everything else is gone.
Yeah.
But
those things are dominant with sleeping. No, you have nutrient. You're breathing.
Well, no, but three.
Oh, correct.
Yeah.
So, but there's a difference between the sleeper and the brain dead person.
They look the same.
The sleeper, though, doesn't have the function, but he hasn't lost the capability to function.
That's right, yeah.
But the brain dead person
has lost the capability.
Not only does not have the function, but he's lost
the capability. Right.
People actively think while they're asleep. People don't actively think while they're brain dead.